101.9 FM.
Hello, I am Farha Khan. Welcome to a special edition of Prof Talk. Prof Talk, I talked to Dean Emeritus Marty Hollenberg from the UBC Faculty of Medicine. I caught up with Dr. Hollenberg and discussed with him some of the accomplishments made by the Faculty of Medicine while he was dean, as well as what he is currently doing outside of academia since his retirement. Stay tuned. Dr. Hollenberg, thank you for joining us today. Can you bring us back for a moment to the time when you were Dean of the Faculty of Medicine? What was that like, and what are some of your fondest memories?
Well, I started here as Dean of Medicine in 1990 and went through to 1996. And it was a great time. I had lots of wonderful things to do. And we accomplished a whole lot. When I came, I had an idea for developing research centers, following up on what I'd done when I was dean at Western with the Robarts Research Institute. And I thought that could be repeated here many times over and would give a huge impetus to medical research at UBC and in Vancouver. So I wrote with David Hardwick's help, Dr. David Hardwick, former head of pathology here, with his help, I wrote a forward-looking document as to how we should develop, which we called Medicine 2000. And it called for the development of several research centers. And all of them actually came into being, and they all have done wonderfully. For example, there's the Brain Research Center at University Hospital. Hospitals were involved as partners in every one of these. Well, now the Brain Research Center is one of the leading research centers in the world in neuroscience. It has hundreds of scientists working there, and it's here on the UBC campus at University Hospital. Another, Max Snatter is the leader of that research center. Another one is a genetics research center over at Children's Hospital. I believe you interviewed Michael Hayden. He's the head of that center. They call it Molecular Medicine Therapeutics. Mm-hmm. Over at Vancouver Hospital, you've got Prostate Research Center. Larry Goldenberg heads that up. One of the premier institutes for prostate research in the world. Mm-hmm. And that started as part of this group. Cancer research, Victor Ling is playing an important role in developing that. That's done at the Cancer Research Building next to the Vancouver Hospital. Over at St. Paul's, Bruce McManus and Jim Hogg are leading heart and brain heart and lung research. And that's going great guns. The AIDS research group at St. Paul's is the premier AIDS research group in Canada. Julio Montaner, he comes to mind when I think of that AIDS group and the wonderful things he's doing. And there are other groups that came together while I was dean. We laid the foundation for a huge increase in medical research, doubling, tripling, quadrupling. And that's gone on. So I'm very pleased with what we started and how it's developed. Now, we also had a job to do in developing medical education. We had a pretty traditional medical education timetable in those days when I started. Lots of labs, lots of lectures. Students were in lectures all day. And it was time to develop a completely new curriculum. So I set up a committee to look into that. From my limited budget, I managed to find funds so they could look at curricula at other places like Albuquerque, New Mexico, for example, comes to mind as one we really liked. And then we brought in experts on medical education, too. And the committee came up with a plan for a new curriculum which involved problem-based learning, case-based learning. Lots of input from the students as to their own learning. And that curriculum was planned while I was dean, implemented the first year of John Cairns' tenure as dean. He followed me. And he put that into place, and it's going until this day. And in fact, I still teach in that curriculum. Yeah. And enjoy it. I just love it. You end up with 8 students in a group, and you discuss a case every week. And the cases get more and more intriguing as the week goes along, and the students have to study up so they can understand and make the diagnosis.
Right.
And this occupies the first 2 years of our students' learning in medicine. And it's very good because it can be distributed. And so we have students learning in Victoria and up in Prince George, too. And pretty soon, probably in other places. It's a kind of curriculum that lends itself to being farmed out. And you can put it in place in different geographic locales. So that started while I was dean.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're continuing to be part of that program.
Well, if you want to be a tutor in problem-based learning, you have to undergo a training. And that's a few days, maybe a few afternoons. It's not easy to be a good tutor, I found. You have to be very sensitive to what's going on in each member of the group. Once you have that, then we meet 3 times a week for a couple hours each morning. And a block is about 5 weeks long. And so generally you tutor one block, then you take some time off, then you tutor another block. So I usually tutor in my retirement a couple of blocks a year. The first one, which is basic science, a lot of cell and molecular biology. And that occurs with the students coming in the fall, towards the end of August. And then the one I just finished about a week ago was pulmonary, the pulmonary system. I've also done cardiovascular. And you can pretty well do whatever you want. And they'll sign you up, and away you go.
Now, what is that experience like for you, especially now that you're retired?
Oh, it's terrific, because you get a chance to interact with these young minds, and they're fantastic. These kids really can learn. They all have excellent backgrounds. Many of them have circled the world, helped out in underdeveloped countries, and they bring a lot of maturity. The last group I had, there was a pharmacist. There was a gal who'd been down in Southeast Asia helping in healthcare. And so on. Every one of them has an interesting background. And for a retiree like myself, to be able to interact with these students is a real treat. Keeps you young.
Mm-hmm. Do you find things are changing all the time every year when you come back to tutor?
Yeah, they are changing.
Yeah.
Students are different. The students learn in a different way than I did when I was a student. We used books. These students use the internet.
Yeah.
They rarely buy books. They don't read the newspaper. They get their news from the internet. We didn't have the internet when I was a medical student. So things have changed. And it's really nice to see it move along that way. I don't know if we learned as quickly as these kids do. That their ability to absorb and perform is outstanding. I wonder if I would have been accepted into medicine today.
So what do the students gain from you?
Well, I've got a background that is a bit unusual in that I have a PhD. I'm a basic scientist. I did a lot of research. And also I have an MD, and I spent a few years on the wards as an intern and in surgery. So I can talk to them as a basic scientist and take their problems from molecules right through to the bedside.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fact I've been a dean of medicine, now that involves you in a lot of medical politics, in a lot of administration in relation to the hospitals, the teaching hospitals, and the problems that are affecting medicine today are things that interest me from my background as a dean.
Mm-hmm. Tell us what it has been like to have been retired. You retired in 2000, so we're almost a decade now. Tell us about retirement. And what you've been up to.
Retirement is really interesting. It's a totally different phase in your life. And I remember vividly a few days after I retired. Now, I'd been pretty busy as a faculty member. When I was dean, I handled huge budgets and major improvements and major problems. And the next day, I was retired from that. And then a few years later, retired from being an active professor. It's a huge change in your life. Some faculty members manage it well, and others have problems, understandably. Each one, I think, has to develop their own way of coping with it. What works for one, we may not work for another. In my case, what worked was to keep busy. I have a very good family doctor. He said, "Why don't you start walking? It'll be good for your health. You can think great thoughts while you're walking." So I walk at least an hour a day, 7 days a week. Enjoy that. I was sitting at my computer one day, and I'm interested in a lot of things. I was thinking about the great ships that went to try to find a way through the Northwest Passage, like Franklin's Erebus and Terror. And he didn't make it. Mm-hmm. Well, most of them didn't make it. Most of those ships, almost all of them, were British sailing ships. And I thought, well, I wonder, is there a Canadian famous sailing ship besides the Blue Nose, which was a schooner? The Blue Nose, the original one and the replacement were schooners. And I thought, is there a great Canadian sailing ship? So I Googled great Canadian sailing ships. And up came a wonderful website on the Marco Polo, called the Marco Polo Project, and I recommend it highly. And it outlined to me the story of a great ship built in Canada, in St. John, New Brunswick, on Marsh Creek, which went on to become the fastest ship in the world. It was the first ship to circle the Earth in under 6 months. And also did it twice in under a year. No ship had ever done that before. Canadian built. Mm-hmm. Right in St. John, New Brunswick. Sir, before Confederation, it was built 1850 to 1852. But this is pretty amazing. I didn't know this. Everybody in St. John knows about it, but not many people in British Columbia know about this ship. So I thought, I'm going to write about this ship. I phoned a couple of people in St. John to make sure no one had done it, and no one was doing it. And I sat down and started reading about the Marco Polo and the times in which she sailed. Yeah. She started out as a lumber carrier. She's about half a football field long. And then they took her over to Liverpool, where she was bought by the Black Ball Line, very famous line of sailing ships. James Baines ran it. And they refurbished the ship into an ocean-going ocean liner.
Right.
Put a copper sheathing on it to protect against the teredo worm. And the first voyage of the Marco Polo around 1852, they had on board about 1,000 people. They had a problem with the infants on board. There was an epidemic of measles, and they lost about 50 young children on the way down. That came up in the British Parliament. But anyway, this ship made it from Liverpool to Melbourne and then back to Liverpool in under 6 months. And no ship had ever done that before. And so I wondered and I researched why this was. What was so special about the Marco Polo and where she was able to do this? And people had speculated on this for decades. They thought it was the way she was built. They thought maybe there was her keel had become warped when she went up on the rocks when she was launched. Maybe there were other reasons. Maybe she had a fantastic captain by the name of Bully Forbes. And he really was a bully, but he was a fantastic mariner. And he took this ship around the world faster than you can imagine. Well, I discovered that the reason the Marco Polo was so fast wasn't any of these things. It was because she followed a quicker route, shorter route, by about 1,000 miles. And she followed what's known as a great circle route, which is the route the airplanes take today. And if you want a great circle route, you take a globe and you put a pin in one place and another pin in another, put a piece of string between the two pins, that's a great circle route. And it took the great circle route from Liverpool to Melbourne and then went down where the winds and the currents were favorable. So it was the route. It wasn't the way the ship was built. After Marco Polo showed the way, then other sailing ships came along and did it just as quickly. So that's basically the story of that book. And then after that one, I have a friend, his name is Michael Nesbitt, who lives in Winnipeg. And Michael is in mortgages, but his grandfather was one of Ireland's most famous naturalists. And together with a chap named Edward Wilson, who was a terrific artist and Antarctic explorer, they wrote a book called The History of British Mammals, which became the book on British mammals ever published up until 1950. But both of these naturalists died young. It was just tragic. Michael's grandfather died on South Georgia Island when he was studying the whales for the Natural History Museum when he was in his 50s. And Edward Wilson died coming back from the South Pole with Scott's expedition. They didn't make it on the way back. And there were three of them in the tent they found, and the others died too. There were about five of them who died. And so they never finished the book. A History of British Mammals was never finished by them. Came out in installments up until about 1920. So I decided to remember his grandfather. I would write a book that would tie together what his grandfather had written about the animals, about mammals, and Wilson's pictures of each one. And so I did that, that basically, together with a biography of Wilson and a biography of Barrett Hamilton, Michael's grandfather, comprised the book. But Michael and I were researching the book together in the Natural History Museum. That's where his grandfather spent a lot of time and did a lot of his naturalist work. And we asked them to bring out the material they had on Barrett Hamilton. So they brought out box after box after box. couldn't have been nicer. We went through this material, and in the bottom of one of the boxes, we found a diary. Dusty, the typical story of a dusty diary at the bottom of a box story. And there it was, and we read it, and it was a journal that Michael's grandfather had kept while he was in South Georgia studying the whales and all the other animals that he could find. He was a naturalist of the true source, and very much at the center of the naturalist world. When he died, it was a real tragedy. We decided that we would take that journal and publish it in the book, just as it was. We didn't transcribe it into typed letters. We left it the way it was written, and it comprises about a third of the book.
Mm-hmm. What inspired you to write two very different historical accounts? I mean, one about a ship and one about these two naturalists.
Curiosity. Basically curiosity. And I had lots of time.
Have you always had an interest in history, even though your background is in medicine?
Yes, I could say that's true. Hmm. Yeah, I love history, and I guess I would have enjoyed life as a historian.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. No question about it.
So you're fulfilling that now, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. And you're still working on another book, but you're not going to tell us what it is.
Well, I don't think any author would tell you that. I had another hobby, too, which I did while I was working still as a dean and as a faculty member, which I carried on up until about a year ago. And that is, I'm a trained silversmith. Yeah. And I'm not talking about silver jewelry. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about hollowware. And that started when I was in an antique store, and I saw a sterling silver teapot, which they were selling for about $10,000, and I wondered, how in the world could anybody make by hand a silver teapot? So I went to the library and researched that, and discovered you do it with hammers and anvils and torches and chemicals, and so I learned how to do that, and I was trained by a very good English silversmith, showed me how to make a bowl. And I did that for many years, and so there are several of my bowls scattered around the planet.
And you also play the trumpet.
And the trumpet is another... Now, the trumpet was a way into learning about music. And in retirement, you have time to do that. So, although lots of doctors are musicians, too. There seemed to be some kind of an affinity between music and medicine. But for me, the beauty of it was I heard about Alan Matheson, who you interviewed, who's a wonderful trumpet teacher and has an encyclopedic knowledge of the history of jazz, history of music. And fortunately, I was able to get into his schedule, and I see him about, every 2 weeks for an hour. Gives me homework, just like a little high schooler, and do my homework, and then he corrects me. And we have a wonderful time, because he has this great knowledge. So we play a popular tune, and then he'll tell me about where it fits into the history of music and the great people that were involved in making the great recordings. Mm-hmm. And I joined a community jazz band, and I'm probably the worst player in the band, but they tolerate me, and I enjoy that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also teach Alan, too, about the anatomy of trumpet playing, right?
A little bit, yeah. I'm an anatomist, so you talk to him about that.
Wonderful.
And then I have a wonderful wife and a couple of kids and a couple of grandkids.
Wonderful.
And they're the most important parts of my life.
So you sound like you have a very fulfilling retirement, but do you think it's the case for everybody?
No.
What are the challenges?
It can be really difficult, I've learned. If you don't plan for it, if you don't think about it before it happens, it can hit you. And I've seen people at loose ends, depressed. Previously they've handled major things, big budgets, lots of people, lots of students, one problem after another. They've been going at top speed, and all of a sudden it stops, and the next day there's nothing. So different people, as I said, cope with it in different ways. In my case, it was keeping busy. That's one of the reasons I did all these things. Mm-hmm. You know, I need the challenge. Somehow, my psyche needs the challenge. But there are lots of people who are experts on retirement, and there are many places you can go to get good advice on it. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why you have to suffer with it. Mm-hmm. There probably should be a word to describe it. There probably is a word to describe it.
And are you involved at all with the Association of Professor Emeriti at UBC?
I went to one or two of their functions, but we're trying to start something within medicine, which would be interesting and be a lot of fun to belong to.
So you're part of working on that? Or?
I'm part of a small committee that's looking at that with the Associate Dean in Medicine.
Okay.
So that might be
so. You're quite connected with the Faculty of Medicine.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I have an office in the COP building, which they kindly provided me. I have a place to go every day and write my books, and interview students, and so on.
That was Dean Emeritus Marty Hollenberg from the UBC Faculty of Medicine. have been listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM and via live web streaming on citr.ca. Next week, I speak with Dr. Janet Werker, Director of the Infant Study Center Speech and Language Processing at the UBC Department of Psychology. Dr. Werker discusses her research of infants growing up bilingual and language acquisition in infancy, speech perception, cognitive development, and parent-infant communication. We would love to hear your feedback of this show, so please email us at proftalk@gmail.com. And for an updated schedule of future shows, you can visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com, which is now accessible via the UBC homepage at ubc.ca. And finally, you can also listen to the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening this morning.
Hello, this is Stephen Merritt from the Magnetic Fields, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.